It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WAVE. Great to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich was back in Georgia yesterday visiting Kennesaw State University for a town hall meeting on behalf of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Newt Gingrich joins us now. Mr. Speaker, welcome back.
Well, it's always great to be home, and Kennesaw was terrific, and the crowd was great, and I'm very excited about how the campaign is coming.
You talked quite a bit about the basket of deplorables comment from Secretary Clinton, and you said it's an example of how liberals don't know how to debate, implying, I guess, that they put people in generalized baskets. But what would you say, though, to someone who questions whether Mr. Trump has any moral ground to stand on, whatever one thinks of Secretary Clinton's comment, because of his generalized comments on Mexicans and Muslims and his impersonations of disabled people, just to name a few?
They talk about with disabled people was one particular reporter who Trump had been interviewed by before. And I don't think so. It's a big generalization to go from interacting with one guy.
Certainly, but
he himself has come back and made very clear that he is talking about terrorists when he was talking about dealing with the issue of Muslim immigration. And he's come back and made clear that he recognizes and has said that most immigrants are not, in fact, criminals, but he's also made a point which is valid, which is that there are estimates of somewhere between 1 and 2 million criminals who have gotten into the United States illegally. And interestingly, I recently saw a video in which I was sitting in the speaker's chair for the first time in 1995 for a State of the Union, and Bill Clinton is delivering a State of the Union. It's on YouTube, in which for a long paragraph, he sounds like Donald Trump on immigration, including focusing on deporting violent criminals. So I think there are places where he has to be more careful in his language, but the degree to which Hillary was lumping half the supporters, and she has since withdrawn that and said shouldn't mean half, but the whole notion, the key I made out at Kennesaw was that they use words like racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic to use her list because they can't debate the issues. So Trump goes to Detroit and Milwaukee and says, we need to fix the inner cities. They scream racism.
Said they have to fix the inner cities. They did that because he said, again, in fairly generalized terms, addressing the black community, saying, you know, your schools are terrible, you're going to get shot. Again, a very general picture of a complex community.
That's true. On the other hand, in Chicago, they've been averaging a shooting every 2 hours. 3,000 people have been shot in Chicago this year.
Certainly, but is that the entire African-American community? And that's how many people heard it.
Well, I think that he was, if you look at where he was speaking in Detroit, a city which has been devastated by liberal policies, and speaking in Milwaukee, which is the sixth poorest city in the country, I think he was clearly referring to situations where it is fair to say, you know, we're not talking about Colin Powell. We're not talking about Denzel Washington. You know, there are lots and lots of successful African-Americans, but there are also several million people trapped in poverty, violence, and ignorance by liberal policies and liberal bureaucracies that don't work.
On that point, you're no stranger to the use of language to affect perception. I mean, you wrote the famous 1994 memo that talked about using negative terms like sick and pathetic and others to describe one's opponents in very general terms to help get out the vote in elections. The bottom line is there a glass houses question here for the Trump campaign, whatever one thinks of what Secretary Clinton said?
Well, my point here today at Kennesaw was that this kind of language is used because the left can't debate anymore. So the left can't debate their policies on Islamic supremacists. In fact, they can't even use the term. And so if you use the term to accurately describe a substantial movement which seeks to impose Islam by force, you must be Islamophobic.
But Secretary Clinton has used the phrase radical jihad. I mean, does it serve any purpose, especially in trying to build bridges to the Muslim community, to say radical Islamic terror when it appears, based on things like the drone campaign, for instance, and the takeout of Osama bin Laden, that the administration is trying to prosecute a war against those terrorists?
Well, the administration is prosecuting the war so badly that Iraq is a total mess, Syria is a mess, Libya is a mess, Somalia is a mess. Yemen is a mess. We just had the Taliban almost take over a provincial capital in southern Afghanistan last week. They actually occupied everything except the major police station for 24 hours and were then driven back out again. So any idea that we're winning this war, and I do two weekly newsletters of Gingrich Productions that are free if people want to sign up for them. And I made the point that 15 years after 9/11, this is not purely a Democrat point, our national establishment has failed to develop a strategy capable of winning the war with Islamic supremacists who are growing in numbers, are more sophisticated, and are determined to defeat us.
And yet, Mr. Trump, while he has criticized how the war on terror, if you will, has been pursued, refuses to say anything about his plan for addressing ISIS. Secretary Clinton has said he doesn't have one. Does he?
I suspect he does, in part because General Flynn, Lieutenant General Flynn, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and has written a very intelligent book on how you'd go about winning the war, is one of his senior military advisors. And I think that's one of the things which is beginning to really bother the Democrats. And you're seeing Trump come up with more and more competent people who are capable of offering real professional advice in their zones. I thought it was very telling when he went to Milwaukee and he developed really his first big speech on helping the inner city, that two of the people who were with him as his personal advisors were Sheriff Clark, an African-American from Milwaukee who's widely respected, and Rudy Giuliani, probably the best mayor in the United States in the last 30 years.
But that speech was delivered to an almost entirely white audience.
And that's because that particular rally had already been organized in the suburbs, but they felt that they had to switch the topic because of what had just happened in Milwaukee. And I thought that that was, in fact, the right decision. Now, he comes back a week later, and he gives a similar powerful speech to a black church in Detroit. And so what's the complaint going to be this time? You know, he speaks out about people being killed in Chicago because since Obama was sworn in, more people have been killed in Chicago, more Americans have been killed in Chicago than have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And the first reaction from liberals is, well, he doesn't truly care because he didn't even go to the funerals. Well, how often have you seen Barack Obama fly in? But if you're a liberal, you get a pass on all this stuff.
Are you saying, though, that you don't hear racist voices among some of Mr. Trump's supporters?
I'm saying that, to take the most the example used by Democrats, Trump has personally, both on television and in writing, repudiated David Duke, and yet you will hear Democrats cite David Duke as the example. Now, when a guy goes on TV personally and says, I repudiate David Duke, you'd think he gets some credit for being anti-racist.
We're already very short of time, but I wanted to pick up on one other subject here. You were a major supporter of the North American Free Trade Agreement. You helped get it through Congress,
right,
saying it would help the entire continent compete with nations like China. Now, Mr. Trump has said it's the worst trade deal in American history, and he would scrap it if Mexico and Canada will not renegotiate. Would you oppose any move to scrap it, particularly if you have a role in a Trump administration?
No. I think somebody once asked John Maynard Keynes why he had changed his opinion, and he said because the facts had changed. And I think our relationship with Canada has worked very, very well. I think in a number of ways our relationship with Mexico has not worked nearly as well, and that reexamining and rethinking the agreement is perfectly reasonable.
But you said as recently as a couple of years ago that it has helped us as a region in our competition with China, and that you would rather have jobs close to the U.S. than have jobs as far away as China.
Well, that's true, which is why I'd also want to place far more emphasis on renegotiating with China than I would with Mexico. But I do think we have to recognize that if you look at the difference right now in balance of trade, Mexico has done extraordinarily well, and we have not done nearly as well out of the agreement.
So you're saying you would move to scrap the agreement or would support scrapping NAFTA if Mexico and Canada do not renegotiate?
Well, I think they both will renegotiate, but I think you're always faced with that choice. I mean, if you end up saying to somebody, I don't think this is a good agreement anymore, and they say, I don't care, we're going to keep you in a bad agreement, you then have the obligation of calling their bluff.
Analysts have said, at least some analysts anyway, have said Mr. Trump's defense and tax cut plans would explode the federal deficit. And at KSU, you were pointing to the balanced budget talks that you conducted with President Bill Clinton. How can Mr. Trump do the things that he's proposing, even if you make cuts elsewhere, without putting the federal budget into a further state of imbalance?
Well, first of all, if Trump focuses very intensely on economic growth, and we get back to a Reagan era, 4 or 5% a year growth, he changed almost everything. If he opens up federal lands to energy and to minerals, you have a stream of revenue. If we focus intensely on applying modern technology to fraud, we think you can save at least $110 billion a year in Medicare and Medicaid. So I think there are steps you can take. And again, I say this is the only guy, Dennis, you've ever interviewed who was speaker while we balanced the federal budget. So I'm reasonably confident we can go back and rebalance the federal budget. But I think we could do it with Trump and not have a hope of doing it with Hillary.
But would the numbers that you cited be enough? Can we grow our way out of this? Many people, including many Republicans, say we really can't.
Now, wait a second. I didn't just say grow our way out of it. I just cited, for example, saving $110 billion a year. That's over $1 trillion over a decade, just by taking out the fraud in Medicare and Medicaid.
No, I was including that, and I apologize. I didn't mean just to say you only meant to grow our way out of it. But even with reductions in waste and fraud and cuts elsewhere, would the numbers support the kind of defense expansion that he's talking about and the kind of tax cuts that he's talking about?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think the tax cuts will lead to economic growth. And I think there are some aspects of his tax proposals that will lead to a tremendous amount of money. So at least $2 trillion locked up overseas right now that could come home with tax reform. That $2 trillion would generate both federal revenue and would generate a tremendous amount of economic growth. So I'm pretty confident we would have better budgets than under Hillary, and we have a real shot at getting to a balanced budget.
One quick final question, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Trump said that Newt Gingrich would be involved in a Trump administration. Would you like to be in his cabinet? Is there a position that you would like to hold in a Trump administration?
No, I'd like to be a senior advisor on restructuring the entire federal government. I think we need some people who can look at the whole thing. And because of the work I did in the 90s as Speaker and the work I did in the Bush administration in health and defense and national security, I think I probably bring a unique level of experience and knowledge to look at the entire federal government.
So kind of a minister without portfolio?
Right.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Mr. Speaker, thank you so much.
Great to be with you again.